Well, you've given me a great title for this Workplace Sunday talk, Godly Ambition. That's the title of this biography by Alistair Chapman of John Stott. And he quotes John towards the end of the book, and the words set the scene for us. It's a good quote. In the end, there are only two kinds of piety, the self-centered and the God-centered. So there are only two kinds of ambition. One can be ambitious for oneself or for God. There is no third alternative. Ambitions for self may be quite modest, enough to eat, to drink, and to wear. Or they may be grandiose, a bigger house, a faster car, a higher salary, a wider reputation, more power. But whether modest or immodest, these are ambitions for myself, my comfort, my wealth, my status, my power. Ambitions for God, however, if they are to be worthy, can never be modest. There's something inherently inappropriate about cherishing small ambitions for God. How can we ever be content that he should acquire just a little more honor in the world? No, once we are clear that God is king, then we long to see him crowned with glory and honor and accorded his true place, which is the supreme place. Let's pray as we begin. Lord, as we come to this theme, we come with a whole mixture of emotions and attitudes and reactions. We need to hear your voice speaking to us personally, deeply, and in a way which changes us. We ask it that you may be glorified. Amen. Well, ambition, getting on, making our mark, succeeding. No, of course I recognize it's not where we all are here tonight. For some of us, this is not high on our agenda, but I suspect it's high enough on the agenda of most of us to at least make it worth spending a few moments together thinking about it. Well, the law is probably the area that I know best, and I read this recently from the senior partner of a major U.S. law practice, talking about his strategy. We like our young lawyers to produce 2,500 chargeable hours a year. We've put living accommodation in the offices because we find that going home spoils their rhythm. And the questioner says, well, Sam, what about burnout? And he doesn't miss a beat and says, no problem, Larry. If they burn out, we don't want them. That well-known quip from Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, is probably truer for some of us in the church than we would care to admit. I believe in God, family, and McDonald's. And in the office, the order is reversed. It's London, isn't it, in a way? That sort of macho culture for so many of us. You put in the hours if you want to get ahead. It's all about the job, impressing, getting noticed, proving we can do it. It's about long days and short nights and shrunken relationships. And even on holiday, there's always time for a quick checking of the iPhone or the BlackBerry or whatever it is. It's irresistible. Charles Handy of the London Business School tells a story against himself of the time when he was working 70 or 80 hours a week. One day he came home and his wife said to him, look, I'm happy for you that your work is going so well. I just think you should know that you have become the most boring man I know. Well, we all know people, don't we, who have achieved an extraordinary standard of living and a simply appalling quality of life. And that's, in a way, the Christian tension in all this, isn't it? Is ambition a ladder that helps you fulfill work's good purposes and the Christian calling in work? Or is it a snake that appeals to our vain and selfish nature with its lure for status and power and money? We view ambitious people in different ways, don't we? Some seem hard-working and thrusting and gobbling up challenges and getting things done. Others seem self-seeking, ruthless, driven, heartless, climbing over other people on the way up and all that. And then we're ambivalent about ambition ourselves. Sometimes our ambitions, frankly, are too grand for our gifts, and they need to be realistically downsized. Sometimes the problem is the other way, and our ambitions are too small because we fear failure or rejection. And so we squelch our dreams and we settle for mediocrity. Anita Roddick, the founder of The Body Shop, remembers her mother saying to her at an early stage, "Anita, be special. Anita, be anything but mediocre." Church has always had an uneasy relationship with ambition. When did you last hear a sermon on ambition? Listen to the great Puritan writer Thomas Brooks. He's not too keen on ambition. Here's what he says: "Ambition is a gilded misery, a secret poison, a hidden plague, an engineer of deceit, the mother of hypocrisy, the parent of envy, the original of vices, the moth of holiness, the blinder of hearts, turning medicines into maladies and remedies into diseases. It was ambition that got Satan and his agreeable angels thrown out of heaven. It was ambition that got Adam and Eve thrown out of the garden. It was ambition that got Judas thrown into hell." Well, at least we know what Thomas Brooks thinks about ambition. And the Bible's always had a horror of what it calls selfish ambition. From the apostles and the church fathers on, that condition has been dogged by an assumption of sin. Why? Because it's a game the world plays. And when it's corrupted, it is plutonium, positively glowing with depravity. Well, contrast this quote from a contemporary Christian CEO. "The world needs Christian tigers who can combine tough minds and warm hearts in a way that they can be Christian, competent, caring, and successful." Well, do you see the tension? Let's not kid ourselves. Without ambition, nothing happens. Churches don't get started, the gospel is not preached, and beyond the church, businesses don't begin. They don't produce revenue. Social problems go unaddressed. Research and development stagnates. There's no human achievement, there's no political change, there's no artistic excellence. Undermine ambition and you rob people of a God-given desire to do something great with their life. So lack of ambition is not a virtue, it's destructive. And yet the wrong kind of ambition is destructive too. For that, frankly, may shrink your soul and derail your life. And that's very serious. It may make you compromise your character and use people in your way. It may turn you into a relentless self-promoter. It may make you a glory thief. And in biblical terms, that makes you an idolater, because idolatry in the Bible is when something matters more to you in your heart and devotion than the Lord. Something is more important than Him. Our ambition and our spirituality are disconcertingly linked. Well, what comes to your mind when you think of ambition? Do you think of it as something that occupies the mind and interest of God? Little wonder that God, speaking through Jeremiah, could say in Jeremiah 45, verse 5, "Are you seeking great things for yourself? Do not seek them." It's a good question for somebody setting out on a legal career to ask. Well, Paul had ambition. We see that here in this passage. He tells us that in the text to which I've now got to come. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 9. It's a wonderful verse. It's full of personal, motivational unpacking of Paul's heart. And I think it can help us. And I want to suggest three thoughts about godly ambition: its height, its width, and its depth. Now look, I know there's not one size fits all in a talk to a congregation like this. For we're all at different stages. Some people here are senior people. established, well off, families brought up, career established. Others are setting out, flattened by the hours and the pressures, frantic about not getting home for the bedtime routine, needing the money and more of it. You know, a case of I owe, it's off to work I go. Others are in what the Harvard Business Review has called midlessence. It's a little bit like adolescence, only worse. Mid-career, burnt out, bottlenecked, and bored. And realizing that in career, this is probably it. We're not going to go any further. That's not easy when you're thinking about a Christian and ambition. Confronting limitations and realities and career disappointments, that's hard. Well, there's a word here for people, I hope, in all those different categories. And the word is this: ambition is all right. It's all right. It's a good thing. And Paul helps us here in verse 9 when he says it, because it mattered to him. Do you see verse 9? We make it our goal to please him. Literally in Greek, we are ambitious to please him, Christ. It's a compound word from philos, love, and timē, honor. It's the ultimate noble ambition to please Christ. The word appears in only two other places in the New Testament, and they're both striking and significant ambitions. The first is in Romans 15, verse 20, where Paul says, "It has always been my ambition to preach the gospel where Christ is not known." What an ambition that is. And then again, and we touched on this morning with Hugh, 1 Thessalonians 4:11, he exhorts the Thessalonians, and don't miss the irony of this in the context of the debate. Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life, mind your own business, and work with your hands. Don't miss the irony of that. Make it your ambition to be free from worldly ambition. And don't be afraid of the unnoticed life. Well, here's my first point. Ambition, the highest goal of all, pleasing Christ. Godly ambition. This puts anything else we're asking way ahead. You know the most important thing in life? It's not being a partner in a magic circle solicitor's firm or being a member of the million-a-year club at the bar. It's being a Christian. Do you believe that? It's experiencing and knowing the call of God in whatever you're doing. And that might be being a full-time mother or homemaker or carer of other people. You see, your work doesn't define you, but your place in God's story does. Henry Blackaby, the U.S. Baptist leader, has said this: to be loved by God is the highest relationship, the highest achievement, and the highest position in life. So here's the first hard question for the Christian to ask in the ambition debate: is pleasing Jesus my supreme life ambition? Is this the ambition to which all other ambitions are submitted? Is this the controlling passion, the driving animation? Paul poses a question for us. Who are you living for? Is it yourself or Christ? The world's first job description in Genesis 1 was a hefty one, and it's unchanged. It's still the glorious ambition to spend our time and talents for God's glory. And that's a wonderful calling. You want the ultimate job description? Here it is in two words: pleasing Christ. Before everything and everyone. Well, what will please him and what will grieve him? Think about how some of this might work out practically. I've got time and I want to touch on just five themes very quickly. But five calls for what this might actually mean in the real world, as we call it. Here's the first: the call to excellence. We will be the best workers that we can be. Now look, that's different from being the best in comparison to others. Comparison is always a very dangerous game because it can lead us straight into selfish ambition. It can lead us to a dangerous place of competition and confrontation and climbing over other people, and that is dangerous to our souls. Mark Green has written, "Biblical success is making the most of what we have been given by God." So we'll be committed, conscientious, careful with detail, ready to go the extra mile. We'll be the people that they want on the team, the people who step forward in a crisis, the people who cover for others when they're under pressure. That gives credibility to the faith. It makes it real. And if our work is shoddy, we dishonor Christ. Never expect him to bless our casualness or our laziness. The firm, the chambers, the courtroom, whatever it is, should be a better place for my being a Christian. Hudson Taylor used to apply what he called the cat and dog test. If even the cat and the dog in your house are not happier for your being a Christian, there's a problem. You know, we pursue excellence not to make partner or to amass cash or to impress judges, but we do it for Christ. And that adds a whole new significance to every task we perform, whether it's noticed or not. The gospel transforms the way we work from the inside out. And that's its wonderful power and its influence. Here's another point, a call to integrity. We will be above reproach people, 1 Timothy 3. The public facade will match the inner reality. We will be shine like stars kind of people, in the words of Philippians 2:15. Trustworthy, self-controlled, truthful, kindly, gentle, forgiving, patient, discreet, and a thousand other Christian qualities. I love that story about the old Don at Cambridge talking to the new Don. Don't try to be clever here. Everybody is clever. Try to be kind. And that determines how we proceed. Because all those Christian qualities matter more than self-focused ambition. And if ambition means cutting ethical corners, why, we'll resist it and renounce it. For a Christian, character always matters more than success. Now, I can't pretend that's always easy and legal practice, and there are all sorts of issues which lawyers will immediately recognize. You know, taking the technical point with very little merit, cross-examining the decent witness to make them look muddled or dishonest, bluffing shamelessly during the negotiations. All these things give rise to issues and challenges. And often we'll get it wrong, yes, of course. But we'll be better lawyers when, as Paul reminds us in Colossians 3:17, he says, "Whatever you do," and as John Stott used to say with classic English understatement, "whatever is quite a lot." Whatever you do, whatever you do. Here's a third thing. We're called to service. You know, we talk of our hunger, don't we, to be upwardly mobile. Listen to these words from Mark 10:43, from the one we follow, the one who himself was supremely downwardly mobile. "Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be the slave of all." It's a strange paradox. Yes, in modern management speak, service is positioned as a means to effectiveness. Jesus goes further and he equates service with greatness. And he offers his own life as an example. And that's revolutionary. And it is deeply counterintuitive in the rat race. As we empty ourselves, we find the fullness of Christ. As we look for others' rights ahead of our own, we're honored and uplifted. We find joy in advancing the successes of others, and godly ambition actually, like Jesus, makes us downwardly mobile. It's a great way to be. Pascal wrote, "Do little things as if they were great because of the majesty of Jesus Christ, who does them in us." You know, we're called to make God's life in Jesus visible at work. We are to embody an unexpected love that wrong-foots people when they confront it. Here's a fourth. We're called to value individuals. See, the trouble with selfish ambition is that it can make you use and exploit people rather than love and honor them. And that's not a healthy or nice thing to do. Some of us will get to retirement and look back at family life saying, "I wish it had all been different." And some conspicuously successful people will know that in the most important area of their lives, their families and their marriages, they have spectacularly failed. Rob Parsons tells a little story of how one day the penny dropped for him one day. He'd been working incredibly heavily, and he worked out that he had, in the first 18 years of the lives of his children, 6,575 days. And no amount of success or money or prestige could recover a single day. By the time his child was 10, he realized he had 2,922 days left. And he realized that they were irreplaceable and unrepeatable. And he determined to make the very best of them he could. And a penny dropped. Individuals valued. Do you remember the 9/11 aftermath? What were the three words that were being said from the burning towers and the hijacked planes over and over again? "I love you." What did the deals and the mergers and the markets mean on a day like that? They meant nothing at all. And everybody wanted to say, "I love you," to those who were close to them. The significance of relationships, that's what we crave. So maybe there are spouses and children we need to treat differently. And there are colleagues and clients who deserve better. In nearly 40 years in the law, I've been haunted and helped by a line from C.S. Lewis's Weight of Glory about the people I deal with, especially the impossible ones. You'll know this quote, I'm sure. "There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. It is immortals we joke with, marry, snub, and exploit." Well, hold that mindset in the center of all the cancer of competition and backbiting and bad-mouthing and trampling on others on the way up. These are precious people, immortals. And here's my fifth point. We are called to personal worth. So many of our work-related, ambition-driven problems arise, don't they, because of our fear of failure or rejection from perhaps unreasonable, impossible-to-please bosses. We spend a lot of time worrying in the workplace, don't we, about what people will think of us. Well, look, let the gospel take the strain. The mind-blowing reassurance is that if you're a Christian, your search for approval is over. The riches of Christ's obedience in life and death are wonderfully transferred to you. And all that energy you're channeling into being liked and praised and working to achieve something to validate your existence, demonstrate your success, why, you can lighten up a little on all this. That's the good news of the gospel. You no longer live for approval, you live from approval. The gospel allows us in a marvelous way to escape from the false narratives created by the idols of the workplace. The gospel creates a whole new self-image for you. You know, it says on the one hand, if I'm feeling a failure, that's right. That is because I am a failure. But by grace, the Lord Jesus Christ has turned that around. But it also emboldens us before others. It tells me I'm loved and honored by the only eyes in the universe that really count. And that's a great help and a great comfort when you're getting it in the neck about something. So the gospel gives me a boldness and a humility that can coexist and can increase together. And it's a wonderful thing. Well, that's the first main point. That's what Paul is saying here about ambition, pleasing Jesus. That's wonderfully liberating. That's the call in Christian ambition. My other two points I can deal with in a few minutes if you're not too weary. Here's the second main point. I've called it ambition, the widest devotion, verse 9. In the body or away from it. What struck me again here is just how wide Paul's ambition really is. Do you see that? The thin line between life on earth and life in the new creation is not interrupted here in his ambition to please Christ. This is a life and eternity concept. Now, how different are perspective on these things. How often we live consumed by the here and now, as if this was all there is. This is the full story. This is my one shot at life, we sometimes say. Somebody has said graveyards are filled with indispensable people. I get invited to a lot of retirement dues at the courts I sit in, and you know they always follow the same pattern. We say lots of warm words, and you know we don't know how we're going to manage without you. But we do the very next day. None of us is indispensable. And it's as well to remember that. So much of our work is relative, isn't it, if we're honest? And what struck me here in verses 9 and 10 is just the sweeping continuity of Paul's ambition. I am committed, he says, to living on earth as I will live in heaven. Or the new creation. I won't go down any path here which will not be relevant there. And in a way, isn't it a marvelous way to strengthen and sanctify ambition? We think, you know, while I'm here, I'm going to get as much money as I can. I'm going to get up the corporate ladder as far as I can. I'm going to build all the power and influence I can. Well, how do these things sound in the streets of the new creation? Pathetic, really, don't they? When you think about it, what's the glorious reality that will prevail there? Well, 1 John 3:2 tells us that we shall see him and we shall be like him. Christ-likeness. Isn't that the goal of life and work now? Isn't that our ambition for the workplace, Christ-likeness? Just as it's our ambition for eternity, we make a start, a fumbling, struggling start. We make a start now because this is the big one and it's worth getting to grips with it. Well, that's the breadth of ambition. We've looked at its height, pleasing Christ. We've looked at its breadth beyond this life, and then finally its depth. And here's the third point. Deepest motive, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. This is a word about ultimate accountability for what we've done with the gifts and the opportunities we've been given. Verse 10. One day the Lord will look each of us in the face and will ask, how have you served me? In Freshfields, in PricewaterhouseCoopers, in Gray's Inn, in the royal courts of justice. No, this isn't a moment about condemnation. No, it's not. Christ has already taken that judgment completely. But it is a moment about evaluation. Because the whole of the New Testament points beyond argument that just saying you're a Christian doesn't amount to a row of beans. There's only one piece of evidence that ultimately confirms you are the real thing, and that is a transformed life. And that's what this moment of appraisal is about at the end. No, we're not saved by good works, but we are saved for good works. And our lives matter. And our deeds are not the basis of our salvation, but they're always the evidence of our salvation. And they should be seen in the workplace. They are the only convincing outward evidence of our inward faith. 1 Corinthians 3 suggests that even with the best of us, there'll be a lot of wood and hay and stubble needing to be burnt off. There'll be a lot of life junk to be cleared before we are, as we shall be, made incredibly wealthy. Well, does that worry you or encourage you in the day job? One day, be sure who we are, all our motives, our grubbiest thoughts, our darkest desires, our meanest ambitions, our greatest lusts will be transparent to Jesus, who will say, "What on earth were you thinking of?" And we'll feel ashamed at his coming. As 1 John 2:28 reminds us, it's possible for a Christian to feel. Well, I've got to end. Here's Paul on ambition. Ambition's okay. It's okay. It's even a good thing if it's the right kind of ambition. In its height, it's about pleasing Christ. In its width, it embraces here and eternity. It begins now, and it makes us ready for the new creation. And in its depth, it reminds us that each of us is accountable to what Oz Guinness somewhere calls the audience of one, the Lord. I remember when I was just called to the bar in 1976, my predecessor as church warden, Dr. David Trapnell, reminding me of 1 Samuel 2:20. I've never forgotten it. "Those who honor me, I will honor." And he also told me, I remember, this: you can get to the top of the ladder and then find it's leaning against the wrong wall. Well, I think he may have got that from the Reader's Digest. It doesn't matter. But I remember it. And he told me it just at the back, church, one Sunday, 1976, 2 or 3 days after I'd got called to the bar. And things happen in church, you know. They're often the very best, being in church is very often the best protection against ambition derailing your life. You know, I always worry whenever people say to me, as they sometimes do, "I'm too busy, I can't get to church." You know you're in deep trouble if you can't get to church Sunday by Sunday. You're in deep trouble. It's one of the first things that goes if ambition is running out of control. The great William Wilberforce had a bit of a spiritual crisis in 1801. A place in the cabinet looked possible, and he said that he had become, as he put it, intoxicated with the risings of ambition. Well, he describes how he got a handle on it one Sunday. Here's what he wrote: "Blessed be to God for the day of rest and religious occupation wherein earthly things assume their true size. Ambition is stunted." Well, you know, nothing has changed in 200 years. It's good you're here. Let's sit quietly for a moment.